Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. There are financial opportunities and momentum to celebrate in Native agriculture, but work needs to happen to support a hopefully growing population of Native farmers. That's according to the 2024 State of Native Agriculture Address. Wild onions are all the rage in Native kitchens because they're in season now. And for Women's History Month, we're taking special note of the Native matriarchs feeding the Indigenous food movement, and that's on the menu after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A group of Anchorage activists in the missing and murdered Indigenous Peoples Movement say there's unfinished business in the case of Brian Smith, convicted last month for torturing and killing two Alaska Native women. They're calling for the arrest of Ian Calhoun, who so far has not been charged with any crime. But as KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, the Anchorage musician has been the target of an online petition and several protests.
Cars honked in support of about 20 protesters lined up alongside the road near Ian Calhoun's home. They stood with signs in big red letters that said, "We do not feel safe, and arrest Ian Calhoun now." Calhoun is a heavy metal drummer who allegedly exchanged text and Facebook messages with Brian Smith not long after he murdered Kathleen Henry in 2019. At the end of Smith's trial, prosecutors brought up something new in the case, evidence that Smith had courted Calhoun to be his confidant. The jury saw text messages between Smith and Calhoun in which Smith tried to arrange a time to show off Henry's body before dumping it near some railroad tracks.
Is there a group of people out there that like to look at the dead bodies of Alaska Native women? We don't know unless APD investigates further.
Antonia Comack, a Native activist and blogger, and also one of the main organizers of a series of downtown protests, says failure to report knowledge of a murder is a crime. During the trial, Calhoun's attorney invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself, so he didn't testify.
We wish that he had, so that we could have heard what it was that he witnessed.
Michael Livingston, a retired police officer, is among the protesters.
The evidence appears to indicate that he not only was aware of a crime, but rather than report the crime, he wanted to protect a now-convicted murderer.
So far, Calhoun and his attorney have not responded to requests for comment. The Anchorage District Attorney's Office and police have issued statements saying there is not enough evidence to charge Calhoun. Protesters aren't happy with that answer. Their petition has now surpassed 2,000 signatures. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
A Washington state tribe is getting funding to return forest lands to tribal stewardship. Eric Tigetoff has more.
The Washington state legislature has approved $25 million in Climate Commitment Act funding to the Quinault Indian Nation on the Olympic Peninsula to purchase 11,000 acres of privately owned forest lands on their reservation. Quinault Indian Nation President Guy Capoman says the Climate Commitment Act is an important law for the state.
It shows that the efforts of not only the nation, but the state as a whole and the concern for habitat and the environment is real.
The Climate Commitment Act was passed in 2021 and created a cap and invest program to reduce the state's greenhouse gas emissions. 10% of revenue generated is committed to tribes. The Nature Conservancy in Washington has partnered with the tribe on the purchase. Capoman says reacquiring this forest land for the tribe is momentous.
Repatriating your lands back. I mean, what bigger goal for a tribe is there, right? Other than the wellness of their members. Those are all things that are instrumental in our existence as a people.
Capoman says Indigenous people around the world have a significant role to play in combating climate change, given their connection to the land.
Knowing how to manage and deal with those resources can show and help the rest of the world in how we mitigate and adapt to what's happening in the world today.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is The Menu on Native America Calling, our regular special feature on Indigenous food and food news. I'm Andy Murphy. I would be a very rich person if I had a dollar for every time someone said their mother's cooking is the reason why they love to cook today. In Native America, women have always been responsible for preparing food and passing down knowledge of flavor, science, and efficiency. That's why this Women's History Month, we're celebrating the women who inspire us and lay the foundation of Native foodways. Then we'll dive into all the layers of ramp season. It is the season in many places for harvesting and adding this sweet, savory, leafy green to traditional and trendy dishes. But first, the CEO of the Native American Agriculture Fund just delivered the 2024 State of Native Agriculture Address. She says there's a growing number of opportunities for tribes and Native farmers to start or expand their agricultural businesses. We'll recap highlights from this second annual State of Native Agriculture Address, and you can join us too. What's the state of agriculture in your Native community? We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Fayetteville, Arkansas is Whitney Sawney. She's the Director of Communications and Policy for the Native American Agriculture Fund, and she's an enrolled citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Hey, welcome to The Menu, Whitney.
Hi, Andy. Thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah. So I mentioned in the intro that there are a number of opportunities for tribal farmers. Can we highlight some of the financial support that became available for tribal farmers in 2023?
Yeah, that's a great question. Excuse me. That's a great question. So I work with the Native American Agriculture Fund, and we are a grant-making entity, and we do fund a number of tribes throughout Indian country. Since 2018 through now, 2024, we've funded a number of tribes, and that been able to provide about $67 million in grant funding. We recently hosted our second annual State of Native Agriculture Address, which is a virtual broadcast which highlights the current state of tribal agricultural economies, the leadership of Native producers, and the tribes that are revitalizing our economies and feeding our people. In that address, we invited Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Secretary Tom Vilsack. He did reflect on some of the resilience and productivity of agriculture and its impact on Native farming, but also highlighted some of the USDA initiatives that are using various acts and funds to support rural and tribal agriculture. They detailed how they're partnering with tribal nations for food sovereignty and land stewardship. And they also recounted some of their investments in water, broadband, and food programs. They talked about some of their new initiatives for bison conservation, indigenous animal meat processing, different school food programs, and also discussing forestry investments that and efforts to ultimately make USDA resources more accessible to tribal nations. So there were a number of examples also through that broadcast where you can see Native producers are getting more involved and tribes are building their own tribal departments of agriculture.
All right. And you mentioned meat processing, which has been a topic I frequently hear about in Native agriculture. Can you give us some of those, give us an example of what you're talking about when it comes to tribal meat processing?
Yeah, so there is a need for infrastructure throughout Indian country. And one of those pieces of that is processing facilities. That could be through fish processing. It could be through meat processing. One example in an area that I am from, I'm a citizen of Cherokee Nation. And in our area, I know that they're working on their own meat processing facility. But also in the area of Quapaw, Oklahoma, they have their meat processing facility. It's open to Native producers, but also other producers in the area, considering it's a rural area. So that's why it's so crucial for these pieces of infrastructure to be invested in so that we can stand up more resources for producers so they don't have to travel long distances to get their meat processed in order to, you know, get their beef or other fish products to the consumers.
All right. And one of the speakers on the address, Aaron Parker from the Indigenous Food and Agriculture Initiative, she mentioned the census of agriculture. And we talked about some of those highlights for Native Americans in agriculture last month on the menu. But can you give us a refresher and one or two Native highlights from this new census of agriculture that came out?
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the findings from that 2022 census showed that there was a slight decrease in the number of Native American producers, but you also saw an increase in other areas, such as increased value in agricultural production. So for example, in 2017, for that census, we saw that there was about a $3.5 billion annual agricultural production value coming from Native producers. But we saw that nearly double up to closer to over $6 billion for agricultural production. We saw growth in young tribal farmers. There's also an expansion of land that was used for farming. One area that is particularly popular among Native producers is the beef, cattle, and ranching industry across the agricultural sector in Indian country. That's about 39% of Native American producers who are participating in that area.
Okay. And you mentioned the number of farms and farmers is shrinking, but young farmers in Native America is going up a little bit. What's been in the works to get more Native people, young Native people, into the agriculture industry?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is this incredible motivation and inspiration coming from our young leaders who are wanting to get involved in agriculture. For example, one initiative that we're working on at the Native American Agriculture Fund is a collaboration and an MOU with the future with the FFA organization and the Tribal Agriculture Fellowship Program. That program is something that we were founding funder for in partnership with organizations such as Farmer Mac and John Deere and the Food Foundation for Agricultural Research. And what that is a fellowship program that supports Native youth or Native people who are pursuing agricultural education, a degree related to agriculture. So it can be everything from a vocational degree that is specialized in diesel trucks to veterinary services. But really, it's about more than just that initial scholarship funding. It is also about establishing cohorts and networks of young people who are interested in agriculture. But really, it's creating new pathways because when we're talking about agriculture, it's interconnected to so many areas of our life. It's connected to our economic development. It's connected to our health and wellness, our food sovereignty, food access, health and nutrition. So there are so many new opportunities and jobs out there that our youth can get involved in. We also see another initiative out of the University of Arkansas, It's a week-long program where students can go and they can study the areas of ag law and policy, ag business, ag health and nutrition. And we're just seeing that come through and that inspiration come through from a lot of our youth. In our State of Native Agriculture address, we had a number of Native youth involved. We included them to make sure that we could have their perspectives told. And some of the outcomes of those addresses were that they just wanted youth to be more exposed to how agriculture impacts our lives.
Yeah, so you mentioned Fort Lewis a while ago. You just mentioned a program in Arkansas. Are there many programs that focus on Native agriculture? Are these common right now, or are we seeing like kind of an uptick of more of these programs for Native agriculture?
Oh, absolutely. We are seeing a growth in that area. Just at our organization, at the Native American Agriculture Fund, we fund over 300 plus different entities, and that is at tribal colleges and universities. They are creating agricultural business degree programs. They're providing scholarships in the space of agriculture. We're also seeing that tribes are building infrastructure, but also investing in their youth programming. So we see even at Klamath Trinity Conservation District, for example, they are building bridges between generations and connecting elders and their knowledge for traditional salmon preparation, for example. And we even see the California Indian Museum out in California, where they are helping youth develop their own business plan using traditional acorns. So it really ranges across Indian country, but we see a number of those initiatives being supported each year.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a break right now, but you are listening to The Menu on Native America Calling, our regular show about Native food and food news. You can join us after the break. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Tell us about exciting food initiatives happening in your Native community.
Best-selling Blackfeet author Stephen Graham Jones ends his horror trilogy with his new novel, The Angel of Indian Lake, completing the journey of protagonist Jay Daniels that he started in 2017. We'll talk with Jones about his new book and what it means to explore characters over time. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Archaeology Southwest. Did you know almost all major archaeological sites in the Southwest have been looted or vandalized? Looting and vandalism impact Indigenous people, past, present, and future. Every day, countless Native American cultural items are lost or damaged forever through looting and vandalism. Federal and tribal laws protect archaeological resources. More information about ending archaeological resource crime and how to submit a tip at savehistory.org and on social media at savehistory.
You're listening to The Menu on Native America Calling, our regular feature on Indigenous food sovereignty. I'm Andy Murphy. We're going to move on to our topic on Native matriarchs in the culinary world for Women's History Month. But I want to go back to our guest, Whitney Sawney from the Native American Agriculture Fund. Whitney, there was also the farm bill mentioned in the State of Native Agriculture address. Wasn't there supposed to be a 2023 farm bill?
Yes, and we are seeing that tribal priorities right now need to be included in the farm bill, and we need to see a farm bill happen sooner than later. There are a number of tribal priorities, such as expanding access and control over food systems for our tribal nations, to ensure our food security, cultural preservation, economic sustainability, including tribal parity, and furthering tribal self-governance. And, you know, we mentioned in our State of Native Agriculture address the need for those tribal priorities to be acted upon in the upcoming Farm Bill. So I know that the Native Farm Bill Coalition is a group of tribes and partner organizations serving Indian Country producers that are ensuring that those tribal priorities are included in the upcoming Farm Bill.
Right. All right. So Native matriarchs in the culinary food world. Whitney, I'd like to ask you if there's maybe anyone you would like to highlight in Native agriculture who you think we should know about.
Yeah, I think that there's an amazing movement that we're seeing from Native women as leaders in the space of agriculture. Even just thinking about our organization and how we came to be, we have a number of folks that are on our board that were leading claimants in the Keepsigilvie-Vilsack class action litigation, which was where alleged discrimination happened for Native farmers and ranchers when they were trying to access credit and credit servicing. One of those women is Clarissa Mandan. So I encourage listeners, if you're interested in learning more about Keepsigil, we just released a podcast called Produced in Indian Country. And on that podcast, we have our lead claimant, Porter Holder, but also Calista Mandan, and her recounting an experience as a leader during that time in putting forward the voices of the producers as they worked tirelessly to ensure that their lands and that their productions were valued. And so I definitely encourage listeners there. I know, even as you mentioned at the top of the hour, how a lot of our connections to food start with our mothers and grandmothers. Even just for me, I think about how my grandmother was involved in food and food security and ensuring that she was able to express her love through food. So when we're talking about agriculture, we're really talking also about our food systems and how we're going to ensure that for future generations. And so it's really just exciting to see all the Native women that are involved in this space and continuing this work.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much. So I want to move on to our next guest here. Joining us from Michigan is Elena Terry. She's the executive chef and founder of Wild Berries, and she is a Ho-Chunk. Welcome back, Elena.
Hi, Andy. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and speaking of the Native Farm Bill Coalition, you're also part of that too, right?
I am. I feel as a chef, it's important for me to use my voice to help advocate for, you know, sustainable practices to help build the tribal infrastructure that we need to make sure that the next generation will be supported. And there's actually a very specific subsection of the Farm Bill called Food is Medicine, which is part of what the work we do with Wild Berries focuses on. However, the way it's stated right now, it focuses primarily on nutritional aspects. We do a lot of advocacy to help say that, you know, food really is medicine, and there's a lot more than nutritional value that comes from our food sources.
Right, right. We'll definitely be watching out for the Farm Bill this year. But matriarchs of Native food, who would you like to highlight? Who should we know about?
Oh, I mean, one of my favorite chefs and just a true matriarch of the food sovereignty movement with chefs has been Loretta Barrett Odin. She's a mentor of mine and also several other Indigenous chefs who she has supported and just has been a beacon, of saying that we can do the things that we love and be successful in this space that isn't always conducive for that environment, which is restaurants. So it's been an incredible journey for me to have her been a part and an inspiration of me being a chef even.
Yeah, yeah. I know she's humble about it. She calls herself an OG of Native food. And she started a restaurant back in the 90s here in Santa Fe. And it really was one of the first Native restaurants there. You know, what does that say about, the power or even the bravery she had to start something like that in Santa Fe, of all places?
Yeah, I mean, it really was instrumental in setting a precedence for others to be able to reach. Like, it hadn't been done before on that level, where she was really celebrating the indigenous ingredients, and not only the ingredients, but also sometimes exclusive techniques that we have. So being able to share that with the general public, I mean, it was transformative for us having space and representation in somewhere like a restaurant setting. It was incredible. And what better place to have it than in Santa Fe, where it is a little bit more receptive of those things. It was setting a strong foundation for the future.
Right. And what about in farming and seed saving? How important are Native women to the traditional farming that we can do today?
Oh, I mean, I can only speak for the lessons that I've been taught, but, you know, when there were times of the male going out in hunting or taking these long journeys, the women were the ones who had taken care of our camps and our spaces. We were the ones who primarily did cultivation. And a seed is a female. You know, we refer to them as she, or, you know, we're going to take care of her. And it's how do we nurture these seeds, not only in the garden and plants, but like also amongst ourselves.
Right. And what about, historically, how have women saved some of these seeds? I mean, some women in tribes had been forcefully removed. Food was used in warfare. I mean, what did it take for for women to bring these seeds into today?
I mean, when you think that these seeds have journeyed with us through removals, through times of disarray and war, like you said, that these seeds have their own lives, you know, they're sleeping until they wake up. And I really truly believe from my teachings that these seeds, you know, they have their own journeys and their own stories, and they're part of us. So we knew the value of that. It wasn't just something that, was because of a time in history. It was that they walked this journey with us. So honoring that, they knew, our ancestors knew the importance of bringing those seeds with us when we traveled, to say that these seeds will help us get home. When we were removed, we knew the importance. They sewed them into their clothes. They hid them in their moccasins. It was important that those seeds came with us, because we would always be connected to our home space and in this practice of cultivating and caring for the land if we had those seeds with us. So they endured, they were strong, and they still continue to grow and to care for us in ways that only they can. I always think that one of the most beautiful things I heard was when my grandmother told me that they have their own destiny, and we need to care for them so that they can fulfill that destiny to be the corn that feeds us for generations, or, you know, these plants that we're also on this journey with them.
Right. So I asked a couple of culinary professionals to add to this conversation about the importance of women in their family. Chef Joe Rocky learned a lot from his matriarchs. This is what he had to say about his great-grandmother, Marion.
I was really too young to understand that she was cooking Native foods or Native-inspired foods. I just knew they were super flavorful, really textural, long before I knew what textural meant, and very different than what all my other friends on the block ate when she was at our house. Even many years after her passing, people would comment on how great of a cook she was. I don't think I really understood that until I got older and could experience other people's food, that she really was that good.
Chef Rocky is from the Pamunkey Indian Nation and from Pennsylvania. He's a culinary instructor, and his grandmother Pearl didn't cook much, but she opened his world to a wide variety of food.
But her and my grandfather would always take me out to different styles of restaurants throughout the Philadelphia area that really broadened my palate as a kid. She'd also routinely slide me a couple dollars and send me around the corner to the seafood restaurant and tell me to get raw oysters or whatever else it was she wanted. By the time I was 5, when my friends were eating peanut butter and jelly with the crust cut off because they were a little too picky for the crust.
And from his mother, Sharon, Rocky learned about how a plate of food, even commodity food, is an extension of the heart.
She made wonders happen in her house with the welfare commodity system we were on many times as a kid. She taught me to use the ingredients that I had in front of me at that time. She was the type of person, she would feed people that were hungry. She would always send you away with a full stomach. When you're at our house, around the dinner table was where people sat and talked. We didn't have much, but if you were at our house and it was time to eat, there would always be a plate for you, no questions asked. When I give you food, I'm literally putting my soul on a plate and handing that to you. I'm giving you a piece of my soul, and that's definitely something that I learned from my mom, to feed and nourish those through food around you that you care about.
And from Taos Pueblo in New Mexico, Adelina Lucero, she's the owner of Dancing Butterfly Naturals and a traditional farmer. She learned from her Taos and Chicana matriarchs the value and importance of energy packed in food and where it comes from, starting with the energy and laughter.
They just enjoyed each other's company when they were cooking, when they were processing food in any way, shape, or form. They were laughing and enjoying each other's company, but they were also putting good feelings and good energy and blessings into those foods. And as a child, of course, I didn't think about these things. I didn't realize that. And, you know, growing up and starting to do these things myself with family and realizing how important those good feelings and emotions are. It warms my heart and it chokes me up a little, but it also brings me to a place where I think about our food system, our current food system in this country and where it's at and how disconnected we are from where our food comes from, but also from the people who are growing that food, the amount of pressure that they're under, the land and water are under attack. That brings me to think about, you know, how important it is to learn how to do something that connects you very closely to your food, to the food system, those foodways, and to that love and good energy that we share.
That was Adelina Lucero, Taos Pueblo, and Chicana farmer. And before that was Joe Rocky, Pamunkey chef and culinary educator. I'd like to go to the phone lines. Here we have Chinupa in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, listening on KILI.
Hey, yes. Thank you for having me on another beautiful topic. You know, to the listening audience, I want to share something real briefly and beautiful. There are 4 grandmothers that a lot of people picked up the staple dietary from our unique health bar. They call it the Tonka Bar, okay, here in Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, South Dakota. But a lot of these ingredients were taught to them from Cecilia Martin, Agnes Lamont, Bertie Spotted Warbonnet, and Gladys Bisnett. These grandmas, matriarchal grandmas, they made this, what we call in Lakota, we call it bapa, okay? It's a form of jerk meat. Leonard Crowdog would use it all the time by that pronunciation. But this way of our bapa, our dry meat, was essential to our everyday diet because it had medicine. When these grandmas made that, they made it out of love. They put prayer in it. So it was such an honorable way of our necessity and our way of life. Today, a lot of our people don't orchestrate, only a few. Clara Laisbad does it, Bernice Whitehawk. These are the ones that still hang on to that matriarchal teaching of that great, 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 unique jerk meat. And so that's what I wanted to contribute to all those guys that are talking about something healthy that continues to work with us as First Nations people, especially here on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Whoopi la tonka to all of you for a good story and a good concept of what dietary can do to save our people in futures to come. Hoka'e from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation.
All right. Thank you, Chinupa. You know, one person I really like to mention is my grandma, Olita Murphy, who just turned 80 years old this week. She really, you know, opened my eyes to just the amount of work it takes to cook, to make food and to put out something that is healthy. She was working in the cafeteria at my boarding school, and she really, you know, taught me that, you know, we shouldn't waste. We should at least try something before we dismiss it, and we should be a little adventurous. And that's some of the things she did at the school, was introduce kids, as picky as some kids were, to different foods. Elena, we're going to go to a break in just a minute here, but I wanted to ask you, in your family, how important are the matriarchs who you grew up with?
I mean, incredibly important. They were the knowledge keepers, the nurturers. They were the ones that taught us everything. I think everybody kind of has those memories. They're beautiful, and I'm so grateful for mine.
Right. We're going to go to a break just now, but after we get back, we're going to talk about ramps and wild onions. I understand they are different. If you want to chime in on this conversation here, we are at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. You're listening to The Menu on Native America Calling. We are talking about food. Every month, this is what The Menu is all about. I'm the host and producer here, resident foodie, food journalist, producer here at Native America Calling. Love talking about food. I want to hear from you. We're at 1-800-996-2848.
I'm Michael, and I used to smoke. I never used to think about breathing. Then my left lung collapsed, and I was diagnosed with COPD. Now I think about breathing all the time. I'm on an oxygen machine so I can breathe. I take medicine so I can breathe. My tip is, enjoy the breaths you don't have to think about. You don't know how long you'll have them.
Smoking can cause COPD. You can quit. For free help, visit cdc.gov/quitnow. A message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
You are tuned into The Menu at Native America Calling, our special feature on Native food sovereignty. I'm Andy Murphy. Green is starting to sprout up from the ground now, and some of those long grass-like leaves you can see are delicious wild onions and ramps. How does your family use wild onions and ramps in the kitchen? What's the most creative way you've seen someone use these root vegetables? Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. I want to go back to our guest, Elena Terry, executive chef and founder of Wild Berries. Elena, is it the season right now up there in Michigan and Wisconsin?
Yes, it's just getting to be the season. Like, you're starting to see the beginnings of the growth and being able to identify where these plants are at.
Awesome. And what are some of the differences between ramps and wild onions?
I don't want to get super technical here, but they're the same species, different genus. So they are all alliums, but they're distinctly different on the leaf structure. And also, like, a wild onion has more of a tube, where a ramp has more of a leaf. They do have a bulb that is very aromatic and delicious, but you don't really want to harvest that too often, because then you're not able to have the plant regrow. And they are perennial, so you want that to happen.
Okay. All right. So when you harvest, are you like cutting off one leaf or one tube? What does that look like?
I think it just depends on the area, because if there is an area that's overabundant, you want to pull some of the bulbs to encourage new growth. But if there's an area that you find and it's just you know, getting started, you only want to take the leaves to leave the bulb in so that it will multiply in the future. And all parts of the plant are edible, which is incredible. So you can really get a lot of flavor if you do just harvest the leaves.
All right. And what's one of your favorite dishes to make with, let's say, ramps, the leafy one?
You know, I like to dehydrate my ramp leaves and then add them into something like sea salt or, you know, to give it a finishing because it makes the plant go a little bit longer and it really does enhance the flavor and in a very unique way. These plants can be anywhere from very mild to incredibly strong flavored. So if you do something like dehydrate, you can preserve it and you can add it and enhance like you would any other type of seasoning.
Okay. All right. So I want to bring in another culinary professional here. Joining us from the Berkshires in Massachusetts is Melissa Baer. She's a chef and owner of Indigenous Deliciousness, and she's Anishinaabe. Welcome to the menu, Melissa.
Hi, thanks for having me, Andy.
Yeah, so ramps and wild onions, I know it is maybe almost the season there in your area. What's it look like there on the in the ground there?
Oh, well, they're not even popping up yet. I went around to look at my haunts and did not see any come up yet. We're due in about 2 weeks. But I'm really excited. It's an exciting time to go into the woods and forage for ramps. And it's just a really, you know, special time to be in the woods. Like for me, I like to get up in the morning. It's very a spiritual practice for me to just go out into the woods in the quiet and, you know, smell the earth and dig for those ramps. And it's an exciting time for culinary because it's beginning of the season, you know, for growing. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to ramp season coming.
All right. And so what is what does the harvest look like where you're at? I mean, how can you tell that it is almost the season?
Well, you know, driving by, you can see little green clusters of popping up from the leaves. You know, ramps, they're more broad leaves, so, and they're kind of in clusters. So, you know, this spot I go to, you know, they're leafy in the woods, in the hillside. So, you know, I can see them when I drive by, and there's a lot of places where you can just pop over alongside the road and head into the woods and grab a few ramps.
Okay. All right. What would your advice be to first-time gatherers?
Well, like Chef Elena said earlier, you know, depending on what the space looks like, if it's, you know, overpopulated or, you know, new growth happening, you want to be mindful of that. But I've been fortunate enough, the place where I usually go is very populated, so I can, you know, get a good couple of cups of ramps dug out in the morning and have my lunch in the afternoon. So,
all right. And what is the difference between ramps and wild onions that you harvest out in the woods, out in the land? What's the difference between those and what we could find in the grocery store, like those big bulb onions and the green onions and scallions? Like, what's the flavor difference?
Well, you know, I find ramps to be very, you know, the bulbs are very small on the, like, they can be pretty small on the end, but they are so, like, odoriferous and can be, like, really potent smelling, like, garlicky, not like the sharp onion, you know. So with the ramps, I just usually use the bulbs for for like kind of like a substitute for if I were going to chop up some scallions and, you know, garlic and ginger up together or something like that, you know, because it is just a little bulb. It's not a huge bulb. And with the ramps, you can use the whole stem and the leaves. I like to blanch the leaves, like kind of cook them separate. I like to use the stem and the bulb for more of like the aromatics of the dish, and then the leaves as part of the leafy greens, but incorporate all of it.
Okay. All right. And what are your favorite dishes to include ramps in?
Well, I like making a ramp butter that you can, like a compound butter that you can just spread on stuff, like chicken thighs, tuck it in between the skin. Yum. And then I also like to do like a faux, you know, I heard your previous guest, Whitney, mention food as medicine. And I am a firm believer in that. And like I love cooking with like ginger and garlic. And when ramp season comes out, I like using all of the ramp to kind of mimic that flavor too. So I'll make like wild rice pho, which is not pho, but it's a nice broth made from those ramps and incorporates the greens and wild mushrooms and wild rice. You know, you throw an egg in there and it's yummy. So that's what I like to do with ramps. I'm looking forward to this season because I haven't tried dehydrating it yet. So that's on my list of things to do this season.
All right. I had a ramp butter once and it was delicious. It was just like a little appetizer for the front of a main dish, but man, that it was really good. It definitely did have a different taste than like scallions or wild onions, even though those kind of look the same. But it seems like they go, ramps and wild onions, they go good with like other earthy flavors, savory dishes, meat dishes. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Like throw that ramp butter on a steak, some lamb. I've done lamb and with ramp butter, and that's tasty too.
Right. So it is Women's History Month still. Are there any Native women you look up to that you would like to tell us about?
Well, you know, you have one on the show right now. Chef Elena Terry is a huge inspiration to me, you know, as an Indigenous woman chef. I've seen Chef Elena just open the doors for people like me. She's so knowledgeable and she's so nurturing with, you know, us seeking knowledge, like just hanging out in her kitchen and what she does with her own community, with the Ho-Chunk community and wild berries. She really is an inspiration, and I can see her knowledge grow and just having her introduce and be part of this, you know, integration of agricultural law and like the food bill and reach, like doing outreach for people to understand what that is. I mean, she's inspiring on so many levels, and I'm just blessed to be able to call her my friend, you know, and my sister chef. And she really, I was really thrilled to hear her on the show. So she's a hero of mine because she does amazing work in her community, and she's just such a sweet soul. Chef Elena Terry and the Wild Berries. I'm really proud of the work that she does in her community.
All right. And what about historically? I know before the show, you mentioned Redbird.
Oh, yes. Vic Collishaw is a huge personal hero of mine. She was a woman from Yankton Sioux. She's Yankton Sioux, and she did so much work within the indigenous community, like 100 years ago, like getting the right for citizenship. And she was a writer, an educator, and an activist, like I said. And I find her so admirable because of her courage to be able to stand up during that time when women didn't even have the right to vote, let alone like an indigenous woman coming in and fighting for these rights. And she continues to inspire me on a daily. I have her picture up just because it's important to remember the women who came ahead of us who, you know, are the trailblazers to where we are today. And Elena is inspiring to me because I see that trailblazing happening, but she's doing her heart and her spirit. It's for the next generation. And that's why, I mean, she's a matriarch and she's a hero, like a modern day lover.
All right. All right. I want to go back to Elena then. Elena, anything else you would like to say about the importance of women in this food movement here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've known you for several years, Andy, and I mean, thank you, Melissa. I'm like very emotional here from that because I think that it's most important for us to see that it doesn't have to be you or me, that this work is being done collectively. And that we offer spaces for each other to shine because that's the way a tribe is supposed to work, you know, like, and that's what we ultimately are, part of this incredible society. And I feel the privilege of being able to have been raised in a way where this knowledge was shared with me. You mentioned I'm from Wisconsin. I mean, I'm blessed right now. I'm at Maple Camp and supporting the spear fishermen. Like, that is what is an incredible blessing in my life. And those blessings are all around us, exclusive to the areas that we reside in. And I think that if we can say that it's us lifting each other up and I see you and I'm ready to show up for you, if that means just cooking a dinner or if that means having conversation, it's changing the narrative on our terms and saying that we can all be successful in this and this true success will become it will come from this knowledge that is being able to be shared and transferred in ways that we've never been able to do before. So I think that we should take this moment and say, like, you know, there is this incredible movement of matriarchs all across Indian country, and I'm here to support that, like, grateful for the opportunity.
Right. And just before the show, you mentioned your grandmother or great-grandmother. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah, I mean, as Ho-Chunks, we don't have a reservation. We weren't technically supposed to be back on Wisconsin land ever, you know, and so we've always been kind of this outlaw vibe. My great-grandmother was the epitome of that, you know, having lived through some of the removals and known, like, immediate after effects of that. She chose not to speak English. She could fluently, but she wanted us all to hear Ho-Chunks being spoken, so she spoke Ho-Chunks. And she had a stove and a modern house, but she chose to cook outside on an open fire. And that was where I learned the beginning basics of really what food as medicine means was from her and these practices that she fought so hard, not for matter of resource or lack of resources, but because she knew the importance of continuing our way of life. And so, I mean, she, Rose White Rabbit Miner, has been my inspiration.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Menu on Native America Calling. I'd like to say thank you again to our guests, Whitney, Sonny, Melissa Bear, and Elena Terry. Join us next week for another lineup of episodes about Indigenous topics and issues, including a talk with horror author Stephen Graham Jones on Monday, April 1st. That's not a joke. It is. It is lined up. We're going to have Stephen Graham Jones on the show. I'm Mandy Murphy. Have a good weekend.
Does your club, institution, or other group need custom branded apparel? A wide variety of t-shirts, hoodies, and much more, all custom printed or embroidered, are available from nativescreenprinting.com, a division of Sky Screen Printing, who support this program. Native Forward Scholars Fund scholarships are open now. Native Forward supports Native students' higher education journeys, offering over 40 scholarship opportunities, programs, and resources designed for Native students. Info and applications at nativeforward.org, who support this show.
Hey, Shay, it's February and American Heart Month. Donya yu yana itonan I kwani kinate donyam temakwe kokshunawa. Ike na weaka takwenulawa kona yoe a les nake donyam asa shina donyante kunashna atekena. Yam donakwa mos awa shuwa to da easternhealthcare.gov in awan and da eastern 1-800-318-2596 na penalakanatu. Look here, sentence for Medicare and Medicaid services don't happen in itulakanawe. Elakwa.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.